Let me tell you a story about a village that is built with his glory. No sorrow in this place, just lift your voice and say, let's celebrate. Look like it's gonna be a lovely day. Come on everybody, let's celebrate. Forget the worries, throw your problems away. Come on everybody, let's celebrate. Show your smile, show your smile, show your smile now. Everybody, let's celebrate. Oh, 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 oh. Let's celebrate.
Hello everyone and welcome to the Village Celebration. We appreciate you joining us today for this special edition. We are looking at police brutality in the Black community, and joining us is one of the leading voices for justice, a former police officer, Reddit Hudson, who is a national voice, has emerged in the past few years, speaking truth to power. Reddit, thank you for joining us.
I'm happy to join you, Vicki, and I hope everything is going well for you there and your listeners as well.
We are a motivated group, and we particularly are interested in what your organization is doing. Now, the name is National Coalition of Law Enforcement Officers for Justice Reform and Accountability. Most recently, you
yes.
wrote an open letter to Black officers.
Yes.
Tell me why.
Mm-hmm. Because of what's happening around us, what's been happening around us for years. I think, and my colleagues in the National Coalition believe, that we have a very important role to play in addressing the violence against the people in our communities that's been committed by police officers around the country. It has a lot to do with race. And we think that from an empowered position, with our histories, with our backgrounds, with our awareness of law enforcement and what that work requires, we are an important voice in making change to a system that is institutionally racist at its core. That's the way that it was set up. That's the way that it functions. Just yesterday, and just to share an incident with you, there was a police officer here, and it's been reported here in St. Louis, off-duty Black police officer, plain clothes. There was an incident in the city yesterday that involved a foot pursuit, and there were some police officers chasing a couple of suspects. Shots were fired. This off-duty Black officer hears the shots, comes outside to assist, but when the officers initially see him, he's ordered to the ground because he was in plain clothes. He had his badge and everything, but I guess he either had it in his pocket, I don't know. But they order him to the ground. Two officers, at some point, they recognized him, and they told him to get up. And start walking towards him. A third officer walks up and shoots him. After he was recognized by the two officers, the two white officers, and told by them that you can go ahead and get up and walk towards us because they knew who he was. And the third officer arriving shoots him, saying that he feared for his safety.
Are you serious? Who is this third officer? Did he not hear his colleagues? What
or
went
see them
on with him?
As they allow the individual to approach. But it's that kind of thing. In the Philando Castile case, if you've seen that videotape, which is horrific, if you've seen the new videotape that was released just today by the ACLU, I think, of yet another Minnesota officer assaulting someone in a vehicle, those kinds of things have gone on forever, and they've gone unpunished. There's been no real accountability for them, and I think a lot of times it has to do with the law as it's written. It makes it very difficult to hold police officers accountable, but more importantly, it has to do with public perception that an officer's subjective experience outweighs everything. And if that person was, quote, in fear of their safety or in fear for their life, then that justifies everything. We know, former police officers and current police officers that I know that in many instances that has nothing to do with it, and it's just an out that officers know is available to them to use to justify all kinds of human rights violations, civil rights violations, and violations of our civil liberties. So we think we have to get into that fight.
To the lay people like myself, when an officer says, I was afraid for my life, and the person they've shot was unarmed, it seems like just something they say, an excuse for taking a life, and
right.
they're able to get away with it. I think that is the core of the outrage, that they're getting away with it. The Philando Castile tape
right.
you mentioned, they seem to have a civil exchange, and all of a sudden, there was right. gunfire.
Philando Castile did everything right. He stopped his car. He advised the officer. Didn't try to surprise him, didn't try to spring anything on him. He knew that he had his 4-year-old child on the back seat. He knew mm-hmm. that his fiance was sitting next to him. So he advised the officer, hey, man, I've got a firearm on me. Just so you know, I've got a permit to carry it.
Mm-hmm.
And the officer winds up shooting him seconds later. You're absolutely right. It's the fact that they get away with these kinds of things. And anybody who saw that tape, Vicky, what yes. strikes me beyond just the horrific nature of how his life was taken was that they couldn't even get him convicted on reckless endangerment, let alone a manslaughter charge. He was exonerated on reckless endangerment, which was one of the charges that was included.
They walked scot free.
It's a travesty, and it's wrong, and that's why I think that many law enforcement people have to get into this work and this advocacy to remake the system, because too many times someone like yourself, who is a competent professional, but you don't have police experience, and that would be the way that they would discount your take on the situation. Oh, Vicky, if you knew what our training right. involved and the kind
these
of situations we face,
decisions
you would never
done.
Question, you know, anything that we do. Well, we do. We do know. We've had the training. We've been in situations. And here's a remarkable point for your listeners to consider, lest they think I'm exaggerating, which at this point I doubt any rational person could believe that. But in the history of the St. Louis Police Department, having black officers on the department, mm-hmm. which is close to half a century now, I can't think of a single black officer that has ever shot at an unarmed white person.
Mm.
Ever. In the history of the department. And I'm sure the same thing is true there in Pine Bluff, Little Rock, any city in Arkansas, any city in the country, any major city police department that has a significant number of black officers, I guarantee you, you'd be hard-pressed to find in their history, not just currently, but over the course of their history, a black officer that's shot at an unarmed white person.
Let's pull back the curtain. What is it like to work with men and women who are white, who carry guns as part of their jobs, and you know they don't value black life?
It's a challenge. And I think you know that you have a job to do, and you know that this is also your livelihood. So you're coming not just to protect and serve, but you're also coming to pay the bills,
mm-hmm.
which I think in many cases is why you've seen a reluctance on the part of some officers to rock the boat or challenge the system, because
sure.
they don't want to put that at risk. At the same time, there can be a level of, I don't want to say tension, but mm-hmm. observance,
mm-hmm.
Detachment mm-hmm. may be a better term, one from the other. This mm-hmm. officer from that officer, knowing that your experience of this work is very different than mine. Your perception of the community we serve is very different than mine. We both have a job to do. Let's function as well as we can over the course of this shift and make it to the end of this shift without any BS from you. So a lot of times officers pick up on what officers are committed to valuing the rights and the dignity of the people in that community, and they will behave differently around those officers. And they revert back to norm when they get around a crew mm-hmm. that's ready to do business as usual.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When did you realize that this was a profession that didn't always treat the people who look like you with dignity?
Oh, I knew it. I knew it before I started. That was one of the reasons I joined. I hope to be a part of changing that culture and serving differently from an empowered position. And what I had seen over the years, I had some good examples before I started. You probably were not in St. Louis when some of the more prominent black leaders on that department first rose to prominence, but a guy named Charles Alphen, He was the captain when I knew him. Me and his son played baseball together. Him and my dad were both coaches of the team that we played on, but he's one of those guys who was just a great example of somebody in law enforcement who served the community and was conscious and who knew the people in the community and valued them and kind of brought that perspective to his work. And so, you know, that's something I wanted to emulate, especially as it would contrast with so much of what not only I had seen, but many of my friends had seen from police officers over the years growing up. So I just wanted to get into the work and do it differently.
When you were trained, and you've been out of the force for a number of years now, but then and now, is there specific training for dealing with those who are mentally ill? And I'm indirectly referencing the police shooting of Charlena Lyles in the Seattle
area. There was not. When I was coming through, and it's desperately needed, obviously, the mental illness, I think, just from a layperson's perspective, not even with a law enforcement lens looking at it, but I think it's fairly pervasive at this point.
Mm-hmm.
I know that myself and the partner I used to work with, a guy named Tracy Cheney, we used to say, and we weren't professionals, we weren't medical professionals or anything, but just from the encounters that we would have in our district, we would say, man, I think mental illness is underdiagnosed in the city of St. Louis.
Mm.
And you can understand, I mean, people are constantly in stressful situations. There's so much deprivation and doing without and hopelessness and joblessness,
yes.
and mm-hmm. money problems and everything else. People break down.
Absolutely.
So you encounter people like that from a position of authority, able to use force against people who may or may not be rational, is desperately needed. Training in that area, I think people are starting to recognize that law enforcement needs a better way to respond to people who may be dealing with a mental history. But in her case, the young woman that you referenced,
Charlena Lyles, and they knew she was mentally ill.
I hate it because I've encountered any number of people who were holding knives when I was a police officer. I remember myself with a guy named Willie Thirdkill. Sergeant Thirdkill has passed now, but he was a sergeant at the time. I was a relatively new officer, and we got a call for a guy who was holding a knife in the department and threatening to do harm to himself and others, and he was mentally ill. We arrived. The guy was seated on the bed. He had a huge knife, a huge knife, like a butcher knife-sized knife, but it was two of us.
Mm-hmm.
We were on. We stood in the doorway while he sat on the bed, and we talked to him for about 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And it was okay for us to talk to him for 20 minutes. Nothing needed to happen in 2 minutes or else.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
It didn't have to de-escalate, to give him time
a bunch of orders given to a guy who's already at his lowest point.
Mm-hmm.
We talked to him, and we wound up getting the knife from him. He left the knife on the bed. We took him to Malcolm Bliss, you know? So for them to, and from what I understand, this woman isn't as big as 105 pounds.
Well, she was petite and
pregnant. So what, she's holding a knife.
And pregnant,
you know,
and had children.
Yeah,
there.
You know, that's the kind of thing. This is yet another example of why I think we need more voices from inside the law enforcement community to challenge decisions like that and actions like that on behalf of a person like that who probably didn't need to die.
So what's next for your group, and how can those who are listening help support your efforts?
We are still pulling at more officers to get involved in this work. There's a couple of officers I've got in mind now. One who I believe recently testified in Cleveland against a police officer who had shot someone without cause. And he was put on the stand and asked if he had ever been in fear of his life or if he thought it was necessary for the suspect to be shot. And in uniform, in court, he said no.
That took courage.
I was not in fear for my life. And no, he did not need to be shot. That's powerful.
Mm-hmm.
There's another one from about a year ago in Cincinnati. Some guy posted, he's a police officer there, who had posted on social media about ways for black people to protect themselves and not get killed by the police when they're encountered by them. We want to reach out to more officers and build kind of a critical mass to do more important work on behalf of the community that's been suffering for so long and add our voices to that. So I think the best thing people could do is just direct them to the NCLEOJ's Facebook page, and they can contact us there. We don't have a website up running. We had something for a minute. If there's a problem with it, we'll probably put something back up here very soon. But that's a good way to get at us. And if there's any law enforcement people listening to this broadcast, please reach out to us. We're more than ready to receive you and allow you to help us do this work.
We really need your involvement and your leadership. What are your thoughts? And then I'm going to let you go because I know you have a busy schedule about meetings and workshops designed to teach African American youth and adults about interacting with the police.
Well, two thoughts. One, I just saw a story recently about New Jersey passing a law that requires all their school kids now to take a course on how to interact with police. Mm. I'm skeptical because of the point of view from which I don't, you know, that course may be taught.
Sure.
There are such things as Know Your Rights workshops, which I encourage the teaching of that information to children and adults alike. But I think more importantly, we need to be teaching these police officers a better way to interact and communicate with the people that they serve. And beyond that, still more importantly, we need to hold them accountable when they fail in any aspect of their work that has to do with our rights, our liberties, and our dignity, especially if it violates policy and training.
You know, the last time you were with us, you said, know your rights, but also know during that encounter when to let things go. You can always come back with an attorney in the heat of the moment.
That's one of the things that I teach when I do Know Your Rights workshops is that all of these things are your rights, and you do have to assert your rights in order to activate them. But if you sense or see that you are standing there with an officer who's a lunatic or who is intoxicated with his or her own power, then you don't need to press too much beyond their ability to manage themselves during the encounter. Just get out of there alive, and then, you know, we can deal with it later. You can check in with their superiors. We can check in with some attorneys. But, you know, if you recognize that things are escalating because you've asserted your rights, and shut it down, because on the street you can't win against the police.
Reddit Hudson, former police officer, national voice for the rights of African Americans with respect to police officers, and one of the leaders of the National Coalition of Law Enforcement Officers for Justice, Reform, and Accountability. We appreciate you joining us, and we're listening carefully. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Vicki. I appreciate you and all the work that you've done here in St. Louis and now there in Arkansas. I hope they know what a treasure they have.
Well, thank you so much.
There.
And we'll be right back. You're listening to The Village Celebration. Honey, did you read this article in the newspaper?
The one about supporting our black-owned businesses?
Yes, that one. It also said Asian Americans keep a dollar in their community 26 days, Hispanics 21, and we, African Americans, only 6 hours?
What can we do to support our businesses?
Well, here's one way. The U.S. Black Chambers of Commerce has an app that helps locate black-owned businesses in dozens of cities.
That's a wonderful idea. Where is my phone?
For more information about the free mobile app, go to usblackchambers.org. The recent events in our country have created a grassroots effort to reallocate assets in a way that sustains and supports the African American community. Some are calling this movement Making Black or Move Our Money. The U.S. Black Chambers of Commerce, or USBC, and Liberty Bank have partnered to offer a credit card with a 9.9% interest rate. The U.S. Black Chambers and Liberty Bank, working together in our community. For more information on the credit card, visit libertybank.net/affinity. Use promo code USBC. Welcome back to the Village Celebration. We are joined now by Jonathan Clark, who is one of the contributors to the Village Celebration and has written a very compelling article about whose life really does matter. We say all lives matter, Jonathan, but is that what it looks like?
You know, it sure doesn't look like that is the case. We are in a place now where we're constantly bombarded by every 2 or 3 months a new person, a new unarmed black male usually, who has been shot by a police officer. And each time we try to move that bar, we say, well, he was wearing a hoodie, or he had dreadlocks, or he was walking in the middle of the night, or he was driving in a neighborhood that he shouldn't have been driving in. We keep moving that bar. Well, this guy had this on his record, and this guy had that on his record. And the further you move the bar, you're coming up with even fewer reasons to justify, and I use that with those air quotes, how these incidents can happen. You know, finally we had Philando Castile, who seemingly appeared to do everything that someone should do right, everything that a motorist should do right. Someone with a clean record and who was well liked and admired in his community. Someone who was called by his admirers the Black Mr. Rogers. And even he, in the space of 37 seconds, and I'm counting from the time the officer introduces himself to the time he unholsters his gun and fires, in the space of 37 seconds, he loses his life. And so,
I want to
go ahead.
I want to camp right there for a little bit on that 37 seconds, because when you watch the dash cam video, it was a civil exchange. Voices were measured. Mr. Castile was compliant. And it's almost as if in the blink of an eye, something went terribly wrong. What happened in that moment, Jonathan, in those moments? Could you hear the time it changed? What happened? Because I'm still trying to figure out how they went from 0 to 100 in no time flat.
Well, Vicki, you know, as reporters, we as journalists, we are trained to try to see everything as objectively as we can.
Right.
And I tried to bring my objective hat to this, and wearing that hat, I had to take it off because it just didn't fit. Nothing made sense about that. I mean, I can't see the moment where things went wrong.
I couldn't either. I didn't see it. I didn't hear it. It's hard to see.
I wanted to try to get it. I wanted to try to understand what is it that the police officer see. And here's the thing. Here's the thing that gets me. And this is the part that I don't quite understand about the jury deliberations or anyone who could say that any part of this was rational behavior. This is a really small part. But we've talked about it. But it's how we talk about this. Castile says, "I'm carrying a weapon." So the officer then becomes agitated when Castile begins to make movements. Now we're all talking about whether he made any movements or not. But let's focus on what it is that Castile said. He said, "I have a weapon." Now, maybe this is just me, and pardon me if I'm getting a bit passionate about this.
No, it's justified.
But maybe this is just me. But I can't imagine someone who's about to shoot you telling
you
that they've got a gun.
Exactly. No, he was transparent.
That's the part that gets me.
He was transparent, which suggested a clear motive. Yeah.
I'm not going to tell you that I'm getting ready, that I've got the means to shoot you. Particularly not while I'm seat belted inside a car.
With my child and my fiance.
With my child.
Yeah.
Right. That part just doesn't make sense to me. If you know, and so somewhere in between him saying that, and now we're talking about literally the space of fewer than 10 seconds. We're talking about a gentleman saying, "I've got a weapon. I'm not telling you I have a weapon for the purpose of shooting you." But somewhere in the officer's mind, he's calculating this as he has a weapon and he may shoot me.
But that's also protocol. That is protocol when you carry a gun, that you say to an officer who stops you, I have a weapon.
And, and, But I don't want us to miss this part, and you're absolutely right. But we have to make sure that we really drill down and identify this precisely. But because this is an NRA point. The NRA always talks about what? Law-abiding citizens, right?
Absolutely. Well, they have been...
The NRA says that guns are, that our guns are safe, they're fine, in the hands of law-abiding citizens.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the deal. If I'm telling you I have a gun, then that's evidence that I'm a law-abiding citizen.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was obvious.
That ought to be the logical thing that ought to register in the police officer's mind is this is a law-abiding citizen, because someone who's not law-abiding isn't going to tell me that he has a weapon in the car. But somehow the police officer looks at Castile appearing to fit whichever identifier or mold that he
identifies. Let's just call it what it is.
And
Philando Castile was black. That was all it took.
And that's what prevented him from seeing this guy telling me that he has a weapon as not being a potential non-law abider.
Well, see, he had a hard time matching the black face and skin with law abiding.
There you go. Even though the black person, the black motorist in this case, committed a law abiding act in identifying that I've got a weapon here and notifying him rather. That I have a weapon here, even though he committed a law-abiding act, he couldn't distinguish that.
Mm-mm.
Because he was still seeing a black motorist in front of him.
He couldn't reconcile.
And his there you go. He couldn't reconcile that.
Mm-hmm. Law-abiding with his skin color.
He couldn't reconcile law-abiding and black.
Mm-hmm. It's a travesty,
so
that's
the problem.
And that is the problem every single time. Most likely, they shoot us and we are unarmed. Or even armed, but not directing the gun at them. It is their inability to see us as law-abiding, decent people. That is at the crux of these killings that we see.
Yes, and you know I don't want to go so far as to appear that I'm bashing cops. You know, I've got friends who are police officers, and for my friends who are police officers and every police officer, they have the right to return home alive. You know, just like as soon as you finish this interview and this podcast, you've got the right to return home alive.
Mm-hmm.
They have the right to return home alive, and I understand that it's an incredibly difficult job that they perform every day. So I'm not trying to minimize or mitigate.
Well, let's just take that analogy. We have the right to return home alive. But when I get on the expressway, the first car that seems like it's going to hit me doesn't mean it's going to hit me. You know?
There you go.
Just because it swerves doesn't mean it's going to hit me. And so these officers who, at the slightest movement, twitch, or whatever, decide their lives are in danger, don't need the job. If I think every car that slightly crosses the line is going to hit me, guess what? I don't need to drive.
Yeah, and to put a fine point on what you just said there, if I'm afraid of fast moving cars, perhaps I need
to stay at the house or let someone else drive.
And
yes.
That's the problem, is if you are afraid of black people, perhaps you ought not be in a position
to carry a gun
pulling around a lot
and
of black
shoot
people.
Shoot us. Yes.
You know, I mean,
well, now we've solved that.
If black people frighten you, maybe you shouldn't carry a gun around a lot of black people.
Right. No. We are bringing some levity to the situation because there's been so much hurt and so much loss around it. But what I do believe we are also bringing to this discussion is a very valid point. If you are that afraid, then you don't need this job.
Yes, it's not the job for you. It's not the job for you. And I'm not saying it's not a difficult job. I get that. But if it's, you know, it's as difficult as you can handle.
A surgeon who's afraid of blood,
you shouldn't be a firefighter.
Doesn't need to be a surgeon.
Precisely. You might be brilliant and a wonderful doctor, but if your hand is shaky, you probably shouldn't be a surgeon.
Precisely. Exactly. You wrote
and
a little.
I think the fact that these people are in these positions. I want to say this one last thing here. You know, we're at a place where we can't comply anymore than they want us to. You know, there was a guy in South Carolina, you may recall, a couple years ago. The trooper, I believe it was a couple of years ago, the trooper asked him to see his license, to get his license out of the car.
And he leaned back in the truck to get it, and he shot
and
him.
He shoots him.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. He shoots him. There's a guy in Florida, I believe this was last year. This may have been last year or sort of the end of 2015. The guy is laying down on the ground. He's laying on the ground with his hands up, you know, and his client, who, you know, was disabled, trying to talk to his client. He was talking mm-hmm. to police officers and explaining. And the cop shoots him, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You can't comply any more than laying on the ground with your hands up.
Because it's not about compliance.
There you go.
Compliance is an excuse.
So it's apparent to me that all lives don't matter in the same way, and it's offensive to me then when I hear people say all lives matter.
Would you share some of what you wrote in your article, which we have on our website, The Village Celebration? Pick the part that you think really captures your puzzlement around these words or this cliche that all lives matter.
Yeah, it's a really short piece, but I think it's explosive in how it gets at that pain that we feel. I say, if all lives matter, the concealed videos would enrage you, but you're silent because all lives truly don't. That's just something you say. If all lives matter, you'd feel about concealed the same way you feel about warm beer. You'd be as revulsed by this verdict as you were by O.J. If all lives matter, you'd shout the names Castile and Martin and Brown and Rice and Sterling and Garner and Crawford and the whole flipping lot of them. You'd shout about them with equal fervor and intensity and vigor as you bellowed for years about four other Americans who died in Benghazi. If all lives matter, the NRA would be unhinged right now at a law enforcer, at how a law enforcer treated this lawful Minnesota gun owner and carrier who did all the right things in his encounter with police and still lost his life. Constantly you become incensed, bristle, chastise, correct, resist, reject the suggestion that anything short of all lives matter is an affront to blue ones, white ones, red ones, lives. But now, this time, you're conspicuously silent because you never really meant all lives truly matter. That's just something you say to meet those of us who say black lives do indeed matter.
And we'll be right back.
Hi, Amanda. How are you?
Doing really well. How are you settling into your new job?
I like the company, and I really like the town. Just having a hard time finding places for my dry cleaning, car repairs, and restaurant. And I really want to support black-owned businesses.
Have you tried the app created by the U.S. Black Chambers of Commerce? It connects you to black-owned businesses all around the country.
Sounds great.
It is. It helps you locate black-owned businesses in dozens of cities.
That's exactly what I need. Thanks.
For more information about the U.S. Black Chambers of Commerce mobile app, go to usblackchambers.org. Hello and welcome to the Village Celebration. We have a special edition today, and it is centered around one of hip-hop's most prolific and beloved icons, the late Tupac Shakur. Joining me now are Reverend Arthur Hunt and Reverend Jesse Turner from Pine Bluff. Both are working on an effort to utilize the new movie, All Eyes on Me, as a tool to reach young African-American boys. Thank you both for being with me.
Always an honor.
Good to be here.
So how did this idea originate to, if you will, partner with the legacy of Tupac and use that to reach young men at risk?
Well, let me say on behalf of the legacy of Reverend Dr. King, who was murdered in assassination, when you look at that 50-year review of how horrific it was to take a leader of peace advocating justice for all, many people followed that footstep. And of course, Tupac was one who had that admonition. And so here we are, 49 years beyond the assassination of Reverend Dr. King, preparing for the 50th commemoration. And this movie comes out as a tool. It's really a opportunistic moment for us to see how he was fighting for something that he believed in, which was good. But where were the leaders who were to guide him? And so today, as I'm here on behalf of ministry in the College of Aspiring Artists, my colleague, Reverend Jesse Turner, who has worked with the legacy honoring Reverend Dr. King from the Pine Bluff original King Fest for 34 years, we want to really optimize the truth about love and the detriment when we don't put enough love and honor and we see violence, hate, take precedent.
So you just put a lot on the table there, Reverend Hunt. So let's unpack that. Let's start with this connection that you're drawing between Dr. King's leadership mm-hmm. and Tupac's, if you will, reception of community activism
All right.
through music.
Well, edutainment is taking music and entertainment and then putting information that's noteworthy, educating people. And we know that from a biblical perspective, people are destroyed because of the lack of knowledge. When you look at Tupac, his derivative, he comes from a movement of the Black Panther that was alive during the legacy of Reverend Dr. King with a different perspective. Some of the same areas that they were focusing on, but different strategies. And so you have to respect that he had good intentions. And sometimes good intentions may not always have the best ideas. Sometimes good intentions have bad ideas. But we want to get those into God ideas, good intentions, God ideas. So Tupac is a study opportunity to look at his life. And with the movie coming out, now this is what's powerful. You don't get movies and biopics every day. So when you get one, it's up to the vigilant, visionary minds to see why did this movie come at this time and what is it that we can do to get the God factor out of it.
So mining the movie mm-hmm. for the good intentions and a different approach, mm-hmm. an approach aligned with Christianity, am I understanding?
Well, I would say we who are elders and we who are to be trainers and mentors for our young people, we always mix in the religious part or the ministry, the Christian, into what we do. And in order to bring forward, like Tupac did not have the kind of mentor that he really needed as a father. And so I see mentoring being that tool that's needed today for our young boys and girls, but more so our young boys, because Dr. King wanted the beloved community where, you know, there was no violence and peace and everything was equal. But today, because we are not focusing on helping our boys to understand about nonviolence, they become violent on each other. So we are faced with a civil rights issue this day of black-on-black crime. Our young boys are losing their lives in Pine Bluff, not only in Pine Bluff, but across this country. And that's taking away from us the minds, the creativity, those people who could be equal to a better than Tupac Shakur, who was a great I guess you would say, inventor or composer. So we're losing this, and we need men, African-American men, all men, to step up and begin to mentor some of our boys, and using the Christianity piece that Dr. King stood for. He talked about that in his life. So I think we stand on the threshold now as we come into 2018 to begin to push forward more of nonviolence, more men coming forward to be mentors of our young men to try to save their lives.
So, Reverend Turner and Reverend Hunt, in the movie, as you mentioned, Tupac had a connection to the Black Panther movement through his mother, mm-hmm. who was imprisoned at one point and was in love with one of the leaders of the Black Panther movement in New York. Mm-hmm. So, he had this very fierce commitment mm-hmm. to the Black community. How do you find the young men who have that type of heart for the community?
Well, let me say, you find them where they are. Many of them are in impoverished communities, low income, single parent homes, disconnected from school, from church, from cultural enrichment opportunities. So you find them there. And when it comes to young boys of color, a lot of them are aspiring for entertainment careers. They want to be NBA, NFL. They want to be rappers. They want to be in the entertainment industry. And so this is why the corollary of this movie is a good place together. It's speaking their language. It's one of their icons. What did he do that was so compelling? And as Reverend Turner said, the father figure absence, the mentors going to where they are, that's the need of the hour.
And we've also found that since 1997, we've been trying to reduce violence and killing in Pine Bluff. And one of the things that we came up with, one of the ideas, is to meet them on the basketball court. We know that our young men love to play basketball, as Dr. Hunt is saying, that they aspire to be others. So we took it upon ourselves to do what we call SET. Stop, eat, talk. We want to take pizza or whatever else over to the basketball court and say, okay, let's talk for a minute. And that's what we do. We will stop and talk to them. And that's the way we find them. We can always go to a basketball court and find a little bit of everything there.
I like the way you said that. A little bit of everything.
That covers a multiplicity of things.
Yeah. So we go there and we talk to them and find out, get their ideas on situations.
So this program is ongoing?
Yes, ma'am. It has been ongoing. We use it when we started in 97. We did that then because we wanted to reduce violence. We wanted to talk to our young men. We wanted to find out, what are your needs? Why is this happening? Give us some ideas about what we need to do as elders so we can help you guys. And so that's something that we have done in the past.
Some point in the movie.
A little bit of weed, a little bit of women. He said some of everything you can find on the basketball court. Where's that location at? No, that's okay. I'm back to the.
Okay, Reverend Hodgson. Yes. In the movie, Tupac is doing well. His music matches his commitment. And then there comes a point where he seems to lose his way. Mm-hmm. If there had been mentors, do you think he could have been steered in another direction that would have avoided the prison time and then that dubious alliance with Suge Knight?
Well, we have what is being reported as an over saturated amount of violence and corruption. That's the report. In reality, we have not enough love and honor and advocacy. If we have more of that, it will exterminate what we see in the human dysfunction, disease of sin.
And that sounds great.
Yes.
More love, more advocacy.
Yes. Honor.
And honor.
Yes.
But where do you get that?
You get it from being taught. If you honor those who have come before you, their sacrifices, it creates a value. And when you give honor, you put value on lives. When you don't give honor, you teach dishonor. And so when we don't give honor to our elders and to our fathers and mothers and people in our community who have made contributions past and present, that devalues. And when you are at a low level of value, corruption, immorality, it just infests the whole environment.
And we'll be right back. Honey, did you read this article in the newspaper?
The one about supporting our black-owned businesses?
Yes, that one. It also said Asian Americans keep a dollar in their community 26 days, Hispanics 21, and we, African Americans, only 6 hours?
What can we do to support our businesses?
Well, here's one way. The U.S. Black Chambers of Commerce has an app that helps locate black-owned businesses in dozens of cities.
That's a wonderful idea.
Where's my phone?
For more information about the free mobile app, go to USBlackChambers.org. The recent events in our country have created a grassroots effort to reallocate assets in a way that sustains and supports the African American community. Some are calling this movement Making Black or Move Our Money. The U.S. Black Chambers of Commerce, or USBC, and Liberty Bank have partnered to offer a credit card with a 9.9% interest rate. The U.S. Black Chambers and Liberty Bank working together in our community. For more information on the credit card, visit libertybank.net/affinity. Use promo code USBC. Welcome back to the Village Celebration. I am delighted to have joining me today Reverends Arthur Hunt and Jesse Turner, both of whom are very concerned about the lifespan and the quality of life enjoyed by African American boys and young men. We were talking before we went to break about valuing our lives, and of course that fits perfectly with the movement that all of us are so familiar with as of late, Black Lives Matter. That is a rallying cry. How do you teach that Black Lives Matter? Because one of the first things we hear from some is, how can we address police brutality and not address black-on-black crime? So how do we teach that?
You can't address one without the other. I think we have to begin to let our young people know that through mentoring, that all lives matter. Whether the bully kills, is shot by a policeman, or whether it comes out of a gun of a black person, it takes a life. And all lives matter. And so we have to teach them the realization that you can't go around and kill a black person and feel like it's okay, and then if a white guy kills you, something wrong. But I think mentoring, we have to begin to take that step to mentor them, because we know that mentoring works. We know that 85% of people, kids who are mentored, will graduate from school. 80+% don't get on drugs. And it's even higher number for young ladies. So we have to begin to mentor and step up. In Pine Bluff, through the National Care Mentoring Movement and our Pen or Pencil program, we have something like 150, 200 mentors sign up to become or to be mentors.
Are they active, Reverend
Turner? That's where I'm going. We get people to make the commitment to say, I want to mentor a person. I want to be a part of the mentoring movement. But then, because you don't have funding, it's hard to get them to stay committed. We have mentors that are committed to Jack Roby, Watson Chapel, Pine Bluff High School. They're faithful. But then there are others, because we need more than just a few. because we have so many problems. But we need more. And so I guess if you pay them, they'll be there. If you don't pay them, the volunteerism is not there because I have to go here, I have to go there, rather than saying I'm committed to trying to save a life, because we want to save a generation. And if we don't mentor these young boys and these young ladies, then they don't have anyone to guide them.
So the program depends in part on funding that allows you to pay people to mentor.
It's not basically for the funding, but it's basically the commitment. Those who
you
are
need folks to say, I'm willing to help, and not just say it, but then actually do it.
Be there when we call for you. And all we do is ask for an hour a week, just 1 hour. And if we can get 4 hours a month, then that helps us to do the programs in the school districts. And so that's what I see, and that's what statistics shows, is that when kids are mentored, they don't get on drugs. There's a low percentage that will get on drugs if they have someone there telling them. The reason these kids are having their pants sagging is because no one is telling them to pull them up. They have looked at a culture that says it's okay. But we have on belts. We know that's the right thing to do. And as I always tell them the same thing that B.B. King said. He said, when you go out in the community, go like you're going to the bank to get a loan.
Mm-hmm. That's good. That's a good philosophy. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And just to add a voice, what Reverend Turner is doing, we have a coalition. Our network here, of course, the College of Aspiring Artists, Joynet Radio. What we are endeavoring to do now is to mentor us to the movies, get the young boys to a place where they're comfortable, the young girls, screen the movie, bring them into the studio, do a professional profile series on them, start their profile. We have a course that's coming up. We just hired a new vice president, Dr. C. Ellen Washington, to help us with our curriculum, the business of you. Everybody will be labeled black, white, rich, poor, based on your zip code. So be the best you that you can be, as that B.B. King advocacy. When you go out, people look at you, let them get the best look. We just heard of an attorney, city attorney, I think, in Florida, pulled over, profiled. Mm-hmm. Young woman, professional, and they had no reason to pull her over. Now they're trying to talk their way out of it. So we're being watched. And this movie, All Eyes on Me, that's a message. All Eyes on Me, Tupac, but not just him, me, you, us, black men, black women in the United States of America. So
all eyes on us.
All eyes on us. And some people only move based on money. You know, I grew up in a home where my dad, I had to work. I mean, my family had to work. I was chopping cotton at 13 years old. I got $15 a day. And then when I got out of the cotton field, I would come home and I had to do my chores. And my dad, I remember getting me a basketball goal for Christmas. I thought that was the biggest thing that I could ever get. So we put this basketball goal up. My friends come over, but they found out quickly. My dad said, y'all got so much energy. Why don't y'all do this before y'all play? And so we were being guided, but there were values that were being instilled in us. And that's what's missing. We got to get mentors to the movies. The theater in Pine Bluff is working with us, the owner, to help us screen this movie while it's in the theater. So some people will volunteer. Some people need to be paid. We want to do internships. I saw the theater. The lady's working hard. What if we enroll some of these students who want to be actors and performing artists? Well, they need to work in a theater. They need to look at movies and learn about how this is being done. Yeah.
So you two are actively looking for ways to instruct and teach values. Is it a lonely call?
It sometimes seems that way. But
so make the appeal for more volunteers. Why don't we have more people rolling up their sleeves saying, We talk about what's wrong in the community, yet when it's time to work,
we wait for a shootout. We wait for something catastrophic, something emotional to happen. When we start screening this film, CEO of the Joynet Radio, we start talking, reached out to you, Reverend Turner and I, down in Pine Bluff, getting the theater and things ready. Slow. Can you sponsor a child? It's on the internet. Pay $10. We set it up with the theater. They see the movie, get popcorn and a drink. $10. That's not a lot. Jerry Riley, thank God for him. He has made a commitment to sponsor 10. Others can do this. Less than a week later, here comes this shootout at a club in Little Rock. And then you got people saying, let's go out and have a prayer vigil. Get on the microphone, speak in tongues. I'm a preacher. We the preachers. Yeah, we do a whole lot of hype. But when it comes to just being there consistently, that's what the call and the order of the day is. Be there for them. I talk to preachers, don't want to come to the movie or whatever. I'm going to look at it on YouTube. No, you go pay to see a film to help those producers to bring more films out. There's a whole lot of dynamics going on when you see a film like this come out. You don't want to wait for the bootleg and all this kind of foolishness. You want to invest in the creative economy. So what we're saying now, this is just one movie, one avenue. Our coalition getting ready for the 50th commemoration is inviting other partners to join us. We've got the NAACP Little Rock, Mr. Charles. We've met with him. They are, of course, online with many things leading up to the King Holiday 2018. But we want to put a shout out today. You can go to our college website, the College of Aspiring Artists.education, and you can see some of the initiatives that allow you to be a part of this screening and other things, coursework that we want to make available through our network. In the studio here, we're looking to bring these students and young persons, after they see the movie, take a course. Let's get a storytelling moment. What do you want to be? I saw an interview of Tupac in high school, 17 years old. Someone knew he was destined for greatness. He was in the Baltimore School of Arts, and they were interviewing those students. And so that's what our college and network is aiming to do with these 16 to 24-year-old young boys and young men and young girls and women of color and who need our help.
Investing in them.
Yes.
When we come back, we're going to talk more about where you can donate your $10 and where you can get more information. So stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back again to the Village Celebration. We're wrapping up our conversation about All Eyes on Me, featuring the life of Tupac and the effort to use this movie as a conversation starter for young men so that they can find a way to connect with mentors and people who care for them. So where do you go if you want to donate to send a young boy or girl to see this movie? Where do you go?
You can go to the College of Aspiring Artists dot education. A short route is tcaamusic.net.
TCAAmusic.net.
That takes you to our website, and you can go to Happening Now. And Happening Now takes you to this film and where we're screening it at. And you can do a contribution. You can buy a ticket. The next screening is going to be Monday, the 17th of July. And there'll be more screenings throughout the summer while the film is out. And the thing about it is, if we keep the film out, it helps the industry, but it gives us more opportunities to get young people into the screenings.
What time on Monday?
6 p.m. We're doing Mondays at 6 p.m. at the Pines Mall. Other theaters are in review mode, but that's the one that's partnering with us right now.
And that's the Pines Mall in Pine Bluff.
In Pine Bluff.
6 o'clock, tcaamusic.net.
Yes.
If you want to donate. Otherwise, all you have to do is show up with your $10.
Yes.
And go in and see the movie.
That's correct. And okay. You get a small popcorn and a drink.
And you certainly need that.
Yes.
At the movies. Yes. It's not quite the movies without popcorn and a drink. Reverend Turner, final word?
Final words. Mentoring. Mentoring is a low-cost really no cost to be a mentor. And that's what we look at. But you get a real return on your investment. And that is, you can change the life, change the trajectory of our young men and our young ladies to one that will return to us, someone who's willing to give back to their community, that's willing to do all that they can to make this world a better place. So through our Pen or Pencil program, we do that so that we can turn them away from the penitentiary and have them to take on education, that they may be a productive citizen in Pine Bluff and wherever they go around the world.
And so when you all talk of mentoring, it is an investment.
It is an investment.
In the specific life of one child, but in general, it's an investment in the community, planting so that it can be reaped later.
Correct.
So screening this movie helps all of us dig a little deeper into where the answers are regarding the plight of many of our youth. We got questions about Tupac. Did he use his talents, talents of a great leader, a warrior, who was brought here as a black man? Did he warn us what was going to happen to the declining value of black men if we didn't come together for a noble cause? And the questions are, what can we do to help this group? Who will listen to them? This movie is an opportunity to screen, to discuss, to empower, and to uplift. We want to give scholarships for our mini course, The Business of You. We want to take them into a six-month program of development. So when the King Holiday does come, 2018, we want to show 50 at the 50th. 50 young persons who were mentored, who were provided support, and let their dreams be reality 50 years beyond the assassination and the final prophecy. We've done something to give honor to whom honor is due.
And that is the last word. Thank you both for joining me. We'll have to come back and talk a little bit more about the King Holiday, because it is a special holiday this time in 2018. It marks 50 years since Dr. King was assassinated, and it is also the first time in Arkansas where the day will be celebrated independently of Robert E. Lee's
exclusive. And we want to thank you, the Village Nation, for covering this pre, now, and just being able to keep it relevant and in the minds of so many people across the nation. You are a blessing to all of us.
Well, to God I give all that glory, and thank you for the support as well. You're listening to The Village Celebration. I'm Vicki Newton. The contents of this broadcast are the exclusive property of The Village Celebration. Any duplication, rebroadcast, or any other use is strictly prohibited, and it is not permitted without the express written consent of The Village Celebration.